Today, I'm delighted to speak with primatologist Christine Webb about her new book, The Arrogant Ape: The Myth of Human Exceptionalism and Why It Matters. The title of the book itself is a concise and precise description of its two constituent halves. First, Webb tells us how science itself, from pre-modern times onward, has operated with an assumption it keeps reconfirming that humans are not only exceptional, but also superior to other forms of life. Webb convincingly debunks this science over and over again. And most importantly, she explains how this myth has devastating political, cultural, and environmental consequences. Combining scientific and humanistic studies, we go into some detail about what this arrogance produces and why we desperately need a much more humble sense of ourselves. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback, suggest people to invite, and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata-Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. So thank you so much for, to begin with, being on the show, but most importantly, writing this book. It's an amazing book, and I instinctively and urgently was drawn to it because looking at the genocide in Gaza, the famines in Sudan and Yemen and elsewhere, the dissolution of democracy, our global ecological crisis, among other things, I found it ridiculous that we should hold ourselves up as somehow being superior to anything. So many facts point to the opposite direction. So I bought your book and invited you to be on. And then I set out to read the book, and I found that you cover such an immense field in terms of biology, science in general. And also you address these other concerns so forcefully and urgently that the book is this amazing combination of different interests with a central message that is compelling and urgent. And I came upon this paragraph at the end on page 255, and I would love for you to read it. It's the one that begins, as I write.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I wrote this passage, I guess, a little over a year ago now.
Yeah.
As I write, the United States is experiencing deepening divisions and escalating tensions around an upcoming presidential election. Political instability and social fragmentation are not unique to this country, but indicative of broader trends of growing nationalism. I might argue that a lot of the breakdown of the West right now parallels the story of human exceptionalism. American exceptionalism holds that the United States has a unique history and mission to transform the world, giving it superiority over other nations. But the rallying cry, America first, is just as hubristic as the rallying cry, humans first. Both ideologies require us to move beyond the hierarchical paradigms that have too long constrained our manner of thinking.
Wonderful. That was such a perfect and succinct statement. And you built up to it in such a convincing and methodical way. Could you tell us a little bit about how you set out to write this book in the first place?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on this show. The book grew out of a course that I taught for many years at Harvard, and it was a small discussion-based seminar course. And I witnessed how engaging with these ideas transformed the way that my students experienced and related to the more than human world. And also engaging with these ideas and having these conversations with my students had a very similar effect on me. For many of us, the world became more vibrant and alive and animate. And the relationship that resulted from the perception of the world as such motivated people to take action, to help that world and to help other species and to advocate on behalf of the more than human.
Yes. I was going to say that one of the things that struck me as I began reading your book was I kept on bumping up against this feeling like, why didn't I think of that? In other words, you come up with examples that go so against our instincts and
our instincts, of course, are learned. Mm-hmm. And so the one thing that struck me as the millions of examples, but the one which you talk about how human intelligence is measured, and you said we measure humans in environments that they're comfortable in more or less, but then their counterparts, the other animals, are in captivity. Mm-hmm. And so it skews the data enormously. I thought, as I said, I never thought of that. But It's so interesting how we become so conditioned to accept these assumptions about what science is and how science is done. So could you talk a little bit about the ways in which we accept science as being always, well, flawed to a certain degree, but within still fairly normal parameters? And the one story I love in particular is the acronym WEIRD. So Could you talk about that as perhaps one example and then expand out as any way you want?
Yeah. And your response of why did I never think that? I had that myself several times writing this book. And I think that's a testament to the fact that human exceptionalism is everywhere and nowhere all at once.
Exactly.
It's so ubiquitous that it's almost hidden. And I, in the paragraph that I read, then go on to differentiate human exceptionalism from American exceptionalism, because I think American exceptionalism is often much more visible and stated and identified. Sometimes it's not, but it's a phrase that many of us know well. Whereas the human exceptionalism is often not stated so candidly. And because of its normalization and that we don't often name and identify it, it often goes unnoticed. And that is true in many dimensions of our life, in politics, in the media, in our language, in our textbooks and education. But it's also true in our sciences. And that is deeply concerning to me, because science is the way of knowing that many of us have come to trust to explain the world around us and to explain humanity's place in that world.
This whole idea of disinterest, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there are many ways in which I think human exceptionalism has seeped into the sciences, but one of the many ways is through the methodologies we use when we compare the intelligence of humans and other species. And in particular, in my field, I'm a primatologist by training, comparing the cognitive abilities of humans with the abilities of our closest living relatives, the great apes. And many times, those studies compare the intelligence of captive chimpanzees who are living in highly restricted man-made environments. Often these chimpanzees have been separated from their biological mothers at birth. They're often separated from the group during testing. They're subjected to the very human-centric experimental paradigms, like playing with plastic puzzle boxes or computer touchscreens. And we're measuring how they perform on these tasks. And then we're comparing the performance with the performance of humans. And most of the time, those humans are fully autonomous, weird humans. And what I mean by weird is this acronym, not my own, coined by the anthropologist Joe Henrich at my former university. WEIRD is an acronym that stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, Democrat. And he used this acronym to highlight how the vast majority of what we know about human psychology comes from a minority of the population, of a subset of the population known as WEIRD, right? Basically college undergrads, who are highly unrepresentative of humanity on the whole. So both in the case of the chimpanzees and the human participants in these studies, the individuals are highly unrepresentative of the species on the whole. And yet we're making these very sweeping generalizations about the cognitive abilities of these individuals, these weird participants. They come into the lab normally just for the study. Sometimes they're sitting on their parents' laps during the task, and then they go home to their natural families and their natural homes. This is not a valid comparison with captive chimpanzees, many reasons. And so it's just a very common practice that is clearly unscientific, right? It's not good science to compare these populations. And yet we do it all the time. So why is that? Why does that pass? Why does that count? And I argue that it's because of a deeper bias of human exceptionalism at work.
And one of the things that really interested me in particular was when you're talking about children, because many episodes ago, I had a couple of abolitionists on, mm-hmm. and they were talking about, if you look at even children's literature, the whole idea of fairness and sharing and all these things are very abolitionist in some ways. You don't celebrate cruelty or being punitive or revengeful. All those things are bad. You point out in your book that children as well don't grow up thinking of themselves as absolutely distinct from animals, but it becomes a learned kind of pattern. Could you talk about that a little bit? And also, since you mentioned the origin of the book as being in the classroom, I'd like to hear you also talk about how did you come to unlearn all these things? Because here you are having gone through a graduate program and being a researcher. It must have been harder as you went along progressively to resist this aggregation of notions of exceptionalism. So start with children, but end up with yourself.
Yeah, certainly. And going to the classroom and the conversations that I had there with students, this was a question that came up a lot because students would say, isn't it inevitable that we are human-centric by nature, that we would prioritize members of our own species over other species? Isn't that just natural and a given? And don't humans everywhere do that? And so creates this like inevitability around human exceptionalism, that this is just what we do. This is what all species do. And I am delighted that there is a growing and vast developmental literature and cross-cultural literature, but let's talk about the developmental literature, that really addresses this issue head on. And so what they do is they compare the moral sensibilities of young children and adults. And so in one study that I write about in the book and that I often bring up in these kinds of conversations, researchers compared weird human children and adults. So these were American children and adults. I believe the children were 5 to 9 years old. And they gave them moral dilemma scenarios. So they said there's these sinking ships and there's different numbers of humans and other animals on the boat. And you have to choose which ship you're going to save. You can only choose to save one of these ships. There were different combinations of humans, dogs, and pigs on these boats. And whereas most weird adults would prioritize the ship with humans over, even if it were just one human compared to 100 dogs or pigs, children did not prioritize humans over other animals to the same extent. So they would sometimes value the life of a human as much as the life of a dog. And so the ratios were much closer together. And this led researchers to argue that human exceptionalism, the kind of moral privileging of humans over other species, is not something that we come into the world with, but it's something that we acquire as we become enculturated and assimilate into a society where humans are privileged over other species. And there, that study has now been replicated in other countries and contexts. And I think intuitively, a lot of us who live with kids, who know kids, who even just spend time on YouTube watching videos of kids and love other animals. They love the living world and they care about it quite deeply.
Yeah.
And as far as my own unlearning curve, process of unlearning the myth of human exceptionalism, I have always been interested in understanding the more than human. I've always just loved other animals. And I really wanted to understand the mindedness of the beings around me. What are they thinking? What do they need? What are they feeling? And that has really stayed with me throughout my entire training as a scientist. But as I write about in the book and you are alluding to, you go through your training as an academic and as a scientist, often you're taught or told that to engage with the mindedness of the living world, to really ask questions about the intellectual abilities, the emotions, is anthropomorphic or it's somehow forbidden and non-scientific. And I certainly learned that many times throughout my training and was sometimes compelled by it, but often it didn't really sit right and it never really felt right to me. And it actually took meeting a group of like-minded scientists, so researchers who were in my field or in adjacent fields who were really open to questioning the kind of orthodox treatment of other beings in science and also how it's not just ethically impermissible, but scientifically questionable too, and really finding community with each other and validating and giving each other permission really to question these things. And that empowered me. And I think in part because I went through the scientific training and I went through this process, I was equipped to write this book in some ways because I was, I don't know, sometimes I felt like I was an infiltrator in science, like thinking about it a little bit differently.
Absolutely.
Studying what it wasn't quite getting right or what biases I thought it wasn't really engaging with or interrogating enough.
Yeah, they call it a discipline for a reason, right?
Yeah.
And this resonates so much with discussions I've had with graduate students here, especially after, I think it was a couple of years ago, that our new School for Sustainability, the DOR School, proudly announced it would take money from anybody who wanted to help, including fossil fuel companies. And the students protested vigorously and still protesting. And yet they tell stories about going and talking to their advisors. And often the first comment is the deadly comment, "I admire your passion." And then the next shoe is, but, exactly. But you need to separate these two things. You could be an activist, but it will contaminate your research and endanger your employability, ultimately, right? So you're almost invited to leave if you're going to persist in these things. And if you think that's not the way science is supposed to work, science is supposed to be open to discovery no matter where it leads you. But it's become so channeled. And as you point out, it's not just scientists, but all of us grow up learning about how we're special. And so it's deadly in that way. And as you say, when you talk about inevitability, and we'll get more into this in our discussion, but then climate catastrophe is inevitable, right? Yes. If we keep on this track, it will inevitably lead us there.
I just wanted to add, I really can relate to what you're talking about in conversations with students and also my own experience. In my case, and in my students' case, this love that we have for other animals and really wanting to help them, and then being told by scientific authorities, people in the scientific establishment that, okay, I really admire your passion, but if you want to be a scientist, then here's what you need to do. And in many cases, that involved harming the animals, studying their brains, or setting them in cages. And I have had so many students and so many colleagues who got into invasive animal research because they love other animals and wanted to help. And then one day they just find themselves doing horrible things. And it's like been normalized. And this is seen as a way that towards some kind of greater good that no one really fully can articulate and understand.
Yeah. You talk about the dissections and the fetal pigs and all, and it becomes a rite of passage. It's not just a matter of being able to do it, but you're proving something about your commitment to the project. And if you back off it, then, you know, you have to be siphoned off into the humanities or something, right?
Yeah. So the harm that is committed almost in the name of science and or in some cases of love and interest and a desire to help is just, it's shocking.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's putting our benefit above the pain of others. Which again, we're more important. So as we began the discussion, you really branch out and take this human exceptionalism and show how it percolates and infiltrates, to use your word, all sorts of other spheres of our activity. And you talk in particular about if we can make an exception for humans, then what then it often leads to is creating a hierarchy of humans, right? Mm-hmm. So talk about how it affects our understanding of other humans and race in particular.
Yeah. So again, another question that would come up a lot in the class that I taught was, okay, given all the horrible things that we're doing to humans all over the world, how can we even dream of addressing the question of human exceptionalism, right? Of human hierarchies vis-a-vis other animals, when we can't even seem to treat each other so well? And that is a common concern and question that came up, and I understand where it's coming from. But what we do in the class and in those discussions is we draw on the work of a growing number of scholars who are actually arguing that these issues are not as separate as we have been taught they are, or sometimes just think that they are. And importantly, in talking about different forms of discrimination simultaneously, I want to be careful to clarify that in no way am I comparing the unique experiences of the victims of racism and speciesism and sexism, right? We can talk about these different forms of discrimination and at the same time without directly comparing them or the unique experiences their victims have. That said, there's a growing number of studies that show that the way people understand human-animal differences and similarities relates to how they perceive differences within and among human groups. So this is something generally known as the interspecies model of prejudice. And they do really interesting studies where they just have people read like newspaper articles about human-animal similarities or human-animal differences. And then they ask them to rate their moral concern for different humans. And it turns out that when people are prompted to consider human-animal similarity, they're more likely to extend moral consideration to human acts. So there's a causal relationship. There's also a correlational relationship, right? That it just, people who tend to believe in evolutionary continuity and in human-animal similarities tend to hold less bigoted attitudes towards racial outgroups. And there's been a lot of interesting studies on that. And then if you just look historically at the history of human exceptionalism, going back to Greek and Hellenistic thought and Aristotle's Scala Naturae, this hierarchical ordering of nature, with humans at the top and then mammals, fish, reptiles, plants, down to microbes and inorganic matter. But if you look within humans, it wasn't all humans. It was a certain archetype, a Greek white male ideal. And subgroups were not even considered human. They were considered animal. And it was so fascinating to me in doing research that the very same tactics that were used to dehumanize humans by saying, okay, they don't have language, they don't have culture, they don't have whatever capability, are very similar tactics that have been used to relegate other animals. Okay, they don't have intelligible language, they don't have complex cultures, they don't have rationality. When, of course, all of those things were defined a priori in a very narrow way to exclude those groups from having that characteristic.
Yeah. I don't know if you know the work of Amitav Ghosh, but he has this great book about the brute, right? And how this is applied to humans and other human groups, but also to the earth itself, right? The brute force. And so this idea of brute and brutality, and in his book, he says, ironically, as more and more the ex-colonized become more and more quote-unquote westernized, they, in his opinion, become more brutish themselves in terms of parsing out the world in that particular way. So civilizing becomes more brutal in some ways.
Yeah, depending on how we're defining brute, I can completely understand that. And we hear it so much in the words that we use, right? When we talk about other humans as being beasts or savages or rats or dogs or pigs, right? That language is very telling that these forms of discrimination are built on a different edifice of human-animal distinction.
Yeah. And then this term that I want you to talk more about, the survival of the fittest, that's brutality, but in a good way, right? That it's further and further refinements of the necessity of having the human emerge at the top. But if that requires a kind of oppression or brutality toward others, that's perfectly natural. So talk about how this term comes about and becomes associated with Darwin improperly.
Yeah. When I first learned about evolution, and for most people who have just had a evolution 101, they probably remember the term survival of the fittest or struggle for existence, right? Mm-hmm. The terms that have become part of the evolutionary canon and scholarship. And what is so surprising to me, and what I actually, I didn't learn throughout my graduate training at all. I only learned this, I would say, in the last, maybe 6 or 7 years through engaging with work in the history and philosophy of science. The term struggle for existence was not necessarily his own. And in The Origin of Species, he uses these terms, like survival of the fittest and struggle for existence, to make his ideas more digestible to a public that was becoming familiar with the rise of capitalism and with all of the theories and scholarship that was surrounding the rise of capitalism. When I learned about the term struggle for existence, you picture a kind of violent, competitive struggle for resources where one individual is trying to outcompete another individual, and whoever gains priority access to resources in some way deserves that because they've outcompeted the other. But in The Origin of Species, Darwin writes that he uses this term, and I'm quoting him now, in a large and metaphorical sense, to refer to the dependence of one being upon another. The struggle for existence is about struggling to survive together. And in The Origin of Species, he writes about an entangled bank where all of these different forms of life are struggling. They're competing, but they're also cooperating. They're struggling together, and they are dependent on one another. They are not individuals vying for status and success, but everybody is struggling together in this deeply entangled way. And it's just, it's so interesting to me how these terms have been read.
Yeah.
Because it's actually, you can look at the original text and you can see it, that it's not exactly at all what he meant, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about co-evolutionary processes and interdependence. And yeah, that I'll stop there. But there's a lot more to say on the sort of cherry picking in The Origin of Species of terminology and meaning that reflect more the sort of sociocultural values and assumptions of the time, again, at the time of the rise of capitalism and biological realities that Darwin was observing and writing about.
Yeah, and especially industrial capitalism, when you have factories and owners and further parsings of people into these two different groups.
Yeah.
No, it's devastating in so many ways. So I wanted to share a story with you, because now we're going to move into ecology and climate change and plants. Mm-hmm. And do you know, his name is Paco Calvo?
I don't remember. Seriously, I know of his work.
So he was on the show a while back when Planta Sapiens came out. And he tells this great story of meeting the Dalai Lama. I don't think it's in the book. I think he just told it to us on the podcast. And so the Dalai Lama has 10 favorite books, like Oprah has 10 favorite books, and he wants to invite the authors to come and explain their work and engage in a conversation. So he invites Paco, and Paco's all proud of himself and thinking this meeting of a mind of these two people who are against the notion of human exceptionalism, and they're going to bond. And so he meets the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama says, Paco, I disagree with you. I think humans are superior to plants. And Paco says, oh yeah, why? And he says, because humans can move, right? Humans can move, plants can't move. And Paco says, because they're rooted, they can't leave their environment. So they adapt to it in all sorts of interesting ways. So they develop a capacity, you might call it intelligence. Those are my words, but a capacity that we don't have. We think we can flee and escape it, so we can't deal with our environments. So could you talk a little bit about how this notion of human exceptionalism has this cascading effect to blind us to the dangers that we face? And I also love that part of your book when you talk about, I think it was MIT that decided to put this big silicon thing up into the stratosphere. Yeah, I had exactly the same reaction, right? If you solve the idea of the ozone layer with this artificial layer, humans are just going to extract more because they'll think we're safe from that. So we're always going to be postponing the danger or escaping from it. So talk about this cascading effect of our superiority, so to speak.
Yeah, coming back to Paco Calvo's discussion, it's interesting to me, right, the sort of essentialist definitions of humans, right, as moving, because not all humans move, and that doesn't make them less human, right? And so the sort of classifications that we make about human nature are always marginalizing some humans, right? But often those who are already marginalized in some way by our society. And yet their rootedness is incredible adaptation in its own right. And I think when we use what we call human capabilities as the benchmark for intelligence or superiority, we miss out on the unique adaptations that other forms of the ingenuity, really, with they figured out how to adapt to different initial circumstances and flourish given those circumstances. So kind of one of the most convincing examples of this also has to do with thinking about the brain and is what makes humans special the fact that they have these big brains? And there's been all kinds of research that have dismantled these assumptions about what makes the human brain an outlier. And really, it's not such an outlier after all, compared to other primates and other animals. But are plants intelligent? Many people would say no. How can they be intelligent? They don't have a brain. But I don't think those same people would necessarily hesitate to say that plants breathe. Plants do breathe, right? They don't have lungs like humans have lungs, but they manage to breathe. Or maybe let's use a less dangerous example, like fishes, right? Fish, most of them, some fish have lungs, but most fish don't have lungs, but they still breathe. They accomplish the same function, which is exchange of gas with gills. And we have lungs. And you can do this for any anatomical trait, digestion. Exactly. Some animals don't have stomachs, but they manage to digest their food very well. Animals have different kinds of metabolisms. They have different ways of exchanging gases with the environment, breathing. They have different ways of seeing. Some animals lack visual cortex, but they manage to see just fine. And we don't seem to balk at that possibility. But when it comes to the brain and when it comes to intelligence, we're so narrowly focused on a brain and a brain of a certain architecture, namely the human blueprint, equals intelligent. And that's just not how evolution works. Evolution shows us that many different forms can evolve to serve the same function. And we appreciate that with so many other characteristics and abilities and behaviors. But when it comes to, again, mindedness and intelligence, it seems like one leap too far, almost.
I love your discussion of function because different life forms have the functions they need to survive, right? And yeah. So it's not up to us to decide that they should be like us if being like us will mean that they'll die, right? Yeah. So it's a weird type of contradiction there. But yeah, I wanted to talk about, in whatever way you wanted, the idea of how us separating ourselves out of pride, arrogance, will lead inevitably to a catastrophe. The more we can't cooperate with our own fellow beings, including plants and lichen and fungi and all that.
Yeah. So climate or solar geoengineering work is a great way of talking about this because it is becoming a realistic possibility that humans will do solar geoengineering. It's already been piloted in many areas and there have been protests against it. But the basic idea is pumping aerosols into the atmosphere to try to dim the sun. And by dimming the sun, mitigate global warming. And I went to a number of talks about solar geoengineering. A lot of it was actually happening at Harvard. There was a researcher named David Keith who's been spearheading it. And I was engaging in conversations with people who are doing this kind of work. And I became really curious about how are people in this field thinking about the consequences of dimming the sun on other species, not just on humans. And I was surprised that there hadn't been as much consideration as I would assume there should be, given what a massive effect. This is a huge project, right? Dimming the sun. Elizabeth Colbert has a book called Under a White Sky because it would literally make the sky look white. It would change our entire experience of the world. And there are disproportionate effects in the global south versus north, which are also important to be aware of. But I would ask, okay, what are the sort of effects that this would have on other forms of life? And there just was not that much conversation around it. And to me, this is where the real hubris of what you were getting at comes into play, because pollinators, like bees and many birds, use the precise angle of the sun to communicate with each other and find food. It's how this rich language that bees have in the hive, where they communicate with one another, the precise distance and location of food based on the way that the sun is coming into the hive and the way that they dance, the orientation of their dance relative to the angle of the sun communicates to each other, and then they can go pollinate the other flowers. It's an incredibly rich communicative display. And if we dim the sun, how are they going to communicate to each other where food is? And this is not just thinking about it for the bees and the birds' sake. These are pollinators. Our entire food system depends on these animals' ability to communicate with one another where food is. So if we dim the sun, how is this going to affect our food system? And these questions need to be front and center, right? Even if we're only thinking about human well-being, these questions should be top of mind, how these technologies, how these interventions are going to affect the more than human world. And so long as we don't take that into consideration, we will continue down this hubristic path. I was really inspired by the concept of hubris in Greek tragedy, where, you know, the protagonists in Greek tragedies would act arrogant to a point where the entire world is coming down around him and he still wouldn't change his ways. And all of the things that you think you're doing in service of yourself are actually tearing you down. They're actually the things that are going to lead to your tragic demise or downfall. And it feels like I'm not opposed to climate interventions. I think we need to be intervening and doing things. I don't think humans just need to take a huge step back and throw our arms up in the air and say, okay, we shouldn't do anything. That's not what I would argue for. But to the extent that we are going to intervene and do things to try to counteract the catastrophic sequence of events we've put in motion, we need to be thinking well beyond the human. Because if we continue to just think about the human, paradoxically, we're going to lead to the downfall of humans.
So absolutely.
Yeah, it's tragic in that sense.
Yeah, it was frightening to hear you talk about the lack of discussion about the effect of these, quote, remedies. And it comes back to this idea of survival. The notion is we'll survive no matter what. Mm. But what's the quality of the life that we will have? Because as you were talking about, we might not be interdependent as we have in the past if these life forms are endangered or caused to be extinct. You can think of some person saying, we'll just fabricate food. We'll create artificial synthetics and all that, and we'll survive. But again, it's this hubris, right? We'll be able to engineer our way out of this and still be alive and have children, and they'll be alive. But yeah. Look at the impoverishment of our world.
Yeah.
That's completely unnecessary. This is the thing that really bothers me the most, is that our pride is not necessary to our well-being at all. And this may be the part that I'm most interested in, because I'm a literary scholar. I'm not a scientist. My father was a doctor, and he asked me, please don't be a doctor. You'll kill somebody. But you had this wonderful discussion about awe on page 254, and you talk about, in fact, I'm going to read part of it because it's such a wonderfully written passage. You say, awe has recently captured the attention of scientists, in part because it's linked to various beneficial outcomes. These include a collective mindset, feelings of oneness, interconnectedness, and belonging, along with a heightened pro-social behavior. Awe also seems to keep egotism in check, prompting a reduction in self-focus and making personal concerns and goals less significant. These effects are partially explained by what researchers call the small self, a relatively diminished sense of self in light of something deemed vaster than the individual. Awe's ability to locate us in forces larger than ourselves is one reason why it's not always enjoyable, as reflected in the word awful. And then you have a few pages later, a really interesting other term, humility, and you put mm-hmm. these two in conversation. And when I read the word awe, being the literary person, there's a wonderful term called the sublime. And the notion is that the beautiful is for human creativity, right? We can create beautiful things. Mm-hmm. But when we see something in nature that God has created, we're set back. We're in the presence of the awesome, mm-hmm. sublime. And Edmund Burke is one of the people who writes about this. And he says, it's terrifying.
Yes.
It's terrifying that it's just something that's so big that we can't wrap our minds around it. And if you follow Christian notions, that God made that there on purpose to keep us in our place, so to speak. So all the idea of hubris and self-satisfaction, and we can engineer our ways out of this. And in those days, the romantic self would be able to transcend all the limitations. No, there's a point when limitations are important, that we have to come to terms with these things. And this is where I'm going with this long excursus, because I'm getting older. And so I'm facing mortality I'm struggling with it. And I was thinking about the idea of a soul. And I think a lot of what drives, in my interpretation, human exceptionality is we have souls and animals don't. God must have given us this soul because we have an afterlife and animals don't. So how do you read this idea of what we possess that other creatures and things don't, as a way of consoling ourselves about our mortality? And this gets right back into climate change. We can wiggle our way out of it.
Yeah, all of these other kinds of immortality projects too,
yep.
uploading human consciousness to a chip or something like that, or freezing your bodies for future revival. It all seems very fixated on immortality. And there's so much there to speak to. I think thinking about awe quickly, it's interesting because some of my students would say, when I see like New York City, I experience awe. Or when I see a spaceship, I experience awe. And I wanted to validate it. Whatever people experience awe, I wanted them to feel open sharing. But it struck me as you were talking that there's different versions of awe, or maybe it's not really awe unless you have this sense of self-diminishment. So I think sometimes people confuse awe with like power and control and domination. You see something that is powerful and dominating a landscape. And
yeah, mastery. The solid
mastery. Mastery. Look at what humans have been capable of. And and look, I've experienced it too. When I see the New York City skyline, I see it is this, it's this incredible, wow, how is this even possible? But the version of awe that I'm interested in, and maybe this is version of all that is, or it's the way of thinking about all period, or it's the version of all that's more in line with the sublime that you were talking about, is no, it's not. It actually makes you realize how little you control and how little you understand and how very small and powerless you are. And that is where I think the relationship between awe and humility becomes so apparent. It's not in the sense that we can control things, but in the recognition that we have very little power to predict and control what is going on.
And we have on our terrace, we have these bougainvillea, and hummingbirds just love them. Mm-hmm. And I was just watching a hummingbird, and I'm in awe of that.
Right.
And I think, and even when I go on my walks in nature, and I come across a banana slug, and I know that they're no predators particularly like them because they're not very tasty and they're so slow. So it's a good thing. So I'm thinking about what a miracle the world is, right? Mm-hmm. And that it's such a privilege to think of oneself as being part of it. And I don't feel a diminishment. I feel a comfort that I'm part of something and it doesn't, I'm not lost in it, except for in a good way. Being lost sometimes is horribly liberating. The whole book is amazing. It really is of a piece because so much homework went into it, build the case, and the implications you follow through in a really useful way that gets us on a different track, as it were. And you end the book by talking about the need for a humble story. And again, the literary person in me just, great, I love stories. So tell me your version of a humble story or a motif that you think we should start nurturing in ourselves.
I think I'd like to continue to play on this notion of hubris in Greek tragedy, because I had this image. I actually wanted to structure the book according to a cathartic structure, but my editors were like, that's too complicated. No one's going to get it. But I had this image of, in the middle of the book, the arrogant ape continues to build these pedestals, one on top of the other, declaring himself a superior being while the world crumbles around him. And at this kind of turning point in the book and in the protagonist's story, Nemesis, who was the sort of goddess in Greek tragedies who would restore balance and order, strikes the arrogant ape with lightning. The arrogant ape falls into the sea and he's starting to drown. And the way that I envisioned ending the book, and I should say it inspired how I did end the book. It just backstory behind it is that the arrogant ape washes up on shore. So you think the arrogant ape dies, but actually in Greek tragedies, it was never really clear whether it was often not clear whether the protagonist died or whether just what he stood for died. It would happen off stage. And then the arrogant ape washes ashore and mirroring sort of our ancestors, like transition to land. He's completely everything, he's experienced it almost as a child. Everything is so new to him. He washes up on shore. He's in awe of every grain of sand, of the shells and the hermit crabs and the bird life overhead. He is in awe of all of these different beings. And he wants to apprentice himself to them. He wants to learn from them, right? He's not trying to master them or render himself superior. And it was in that moment that he finally learned humility. He's an open mind. He's trying to understand. He's trying to learn from, not prescribe or overdetermine anybody. And coming back to the need for a humbler story, I'm glad that resonated with you. So that's what I think of when I think of humility and really putting it into a storytelling mode, but to put it a little bit differently or to approach it differently, when it comes to the ecological crisis, especially the sort of public discourse around it, you hear all kinds of terms over and over again: overpopulation and habitat destruction and biodiversity loss. And it seems to me that in addition to those things, which we need to be talking about and identifying and studying, if we're not talking about the underlying story and worldview and cosmology that makes all of those systems and patterns possible in the first place, then are we really getting at the root of it? And are our solutions only going to operate through the same exact story, like coming back to solar geoengineering? I'm not saying that technology could never happen or should never happen, but if it continues to operate through the story of human domination and prioritizing humans over other species, then we're not actually fixing anything. We're just enacting a different performance of the same problem over and over again. And story is fundamental. And there's this wonderful, I don't know if the paper, the chapter called The New Story by Thomas Berry, but I cite it at the end of the book. Yeah. And I think you would love it. He basically writes that we're in trouble these days because we're in between stories. We don't really have a good story. And that's, or if the story that we do have is one of dominion and mastery, then that is unsustainable in so many senses. So yes, story is crucial. And I think scientists need to be thinking about it more than just people in the humanities and social. Yeah.
I think, again, getting back to the passage that I asked you to read at the beginning of the podcast, because we see the signs of the devastation that human exceptionalism wrecks in all these different spheres, it's not just climate, but it's all of a piece. Yeah. I think more people are coming about to at least an understanding that this is not working.
Yeah.
This is definitely not working. And doubling down has not got us very far. And yeah, I was again on my walk in the preserve, and this guy in the most horrible t-shirt I've seen in my life, especially in that environment, black and white, one word, dominate. I thought, So I grew up in the 60s. And I said, who would want to do that? And you talk about this in your book a lot. We only have so much energy and intelligence in the world. Why would we want to invest in that? Because to me, domination is an addiction, because you never get enough. Right. There will always be some loophole that somebody has escaped. And this is what we see with Elon Musk and this whole notion of sealing every passage. But it's such, again, being an older person, knowing the finitude of life, which was a huge blessing. It's wonderful in many ways, as long as you understand that you're part of a process that everything else is, even inanimate things are part of.
Yeah.
So your book came out at exactly the perfect time. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it could have been written 10 years before, and I'm not sure it can be written 5 years from, given the political climate. Yeah. So I'm urging everybody to buy this book and read it. It's one of the most enjoyable books I've ever read, because it is so wise and so grounded, and the stakes are so high. And it's also very poetically written. You're a great writer. It's lovely.
Thank you so much for saying that. That means so much to me. And it took me a long time to find my voice as a non-science. We're taught not to put ourselves in the work. And then I had to really overcome that and put myself in it. And that really means a lot.
This is what I tell, I'm sure we tell our students the same thing. To be a good writer, you have to be passionate, that word in a positive way, passionate, committed to what you're trying to convey.
Yeah.
And that's what will grab a reader. And it's something that is clinical, soulless, neutral, scientific, will only work within a particular ambit. It's been so wonderful spending time with you. I can't thank you enough for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've loved our conversation. Your questions are great. It's really refreshing to be in conversation with someone who's actually read the book, as you can imagine. Yeah, I've been getting some emails to your point about this being the right time. I think it's an incredibly polarizing time, and the book is provocative, and there are people who love the book, and there are people who hate the book. And humans are animals. Some people have real problems with this notion.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And in some ways it helps when the criticism actually proves the point. And then some of each of these categories of loving and hating the book, it's very clear when people have read the book and people have. And I take seriously when people have engaged with the book. And yeah, that's very clear that you have. So just thank you so much. And it's been great.
I just want to add one thing before we sign off, which is that we barely scratched the surface. I want our listeners to know this. There's so much in this book that we could have had 3 or 4 programs on it. In fact, we should probably, let's keep in touch, please.
Be happy to. No, seriously. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
It was really nice to meet you.
You too. Bye-bye.